This is Ray Barichka. It is June 18th, 1991, and I am interviewing Judge Joseph Sullivan at his office in Detroit, Michigan. Could we begin, Judge Sullivan, with you telling me a bit about your background, the date and place of your birth, maybe a bit about your family background, your education?
I suppose first I should say that I'm best identified as Joseph B. Sullivan. It so happens I have a brother-in-law who is Judge Joseph A. Sullivan. So would you just say Judge Sullivan?
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Well, I was born on May 30th, 1922, here in Detroit. My father was also a Joseph Sullivan with a middle initial, and he was with the Wabash Railroad. My mother was a Winifred Bruin from Canada. I went to St. Teresa School in Detroit for 12 years and then the University of Detroit. Before I finished at the University of Detroit, I served in the military for 3 years, came back and finished at night school. Married, and we had a child. So I had been working with the first General Mills and then with a publishing firm. And the happy-go-lucky days of a traveling salesman. I covered Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and frequently New York and Chicago for the company.
Was that while you were in college or after college?
I was in law school.
In your law school?
I traveled with two suitcases, one with my clothes and the other with a set of law books. And finally graduated from the University of Detroit.
Was this in the 1930s?
Oh, no, 30s. My goodness, no. This was now 1957 when I graduated from law school.
Okay.
I graduated from undergrad in 1947, and didn't start law school until 1952, at the end of 52. So I graduated from there in 57, was admitted to the bar in 1958, and began to practice with my brother-in-law, Bob Sullivan. Mm-hmm. Jerry and I had known each other from U of D, first undergrad, but to a limited extent, and known each other much better in law school. Mm-hmm. But our contacts always were mainly political. When I'd get a phone call from Jerry, I would know something political was in the air, because otherwise we just didn't have many occasions to get together.
Uh-huh.
And this one particular day in 1961, he called me and asked me to join him for a drink at the Caucus Club. About 5 o'clock, he suggested. We met down there, and I cannot guess with whom we might have discussed this previously, but he asked me what I thought about him running for mayor of Detroit. I showed my political astuteness by saying he couldn't possibly beat Louis Mariani, but I was sure that he could be nominated.
Uh-huh.
We had some idea who those who had announced that they might be running. And I said, I'm sure we can beat any of those and be in perfect position to run for prosecutor, Congress, or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, I'm not interested in prosecutor or Congress. I am interested in being mayor, and I think I can get elected mayor. So I said, well, I still have my doubts, but it sounds like a lot of fun to try, so let's go ahead and give it a go.
Uh-huh.
So he asked me if I would manage the campaign, not the primary. He said, you stick with your law practice till we get through the primary.
Uh-huh.
And one, because you said, I agree with you, we can win the primary without too much difficulty. But after that, it's going to be a tough fight against the incumbent mayor. And so we agreed on that basis that, well, I floated around the primary campaign. I didn't spend the time on it like I did on the general campaign.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did do, because he had suggested to me that there were two basic reasons why he felt that he could defeat Mariani. One was the restlessness in the black community concerning Mariani, particularly because of the police relations. And the other one was a little more amorphic, but it was the concept that even those that supported Mariani really didn't like him that well.
Why not?
I'm about to explain that.
Okay.
He said, Mariani's having a fundraiser it was been a few days, over at Cobo Hall. And he said, why don't you go to it? It was only a $5 deal. Mm-hmm. And see what kind of reaction you get there from the people in attendance. So I did go over. And it was, to me, quite interesting to see Mary Annie enter the hall. Cobo Hall, of course, is a large hall, and the place was packed with people, even at $5 a head. It was a significant turnout. But he came in riding on a cart, and he circled the hall on the cart, just kind of waving to people, and I would hear some rumbling as the cart would go by. Things, but you'd think he'd get off there and walk around and shake hands with people. Who does he think he is? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. Now, these were the people who I presumed were his supporters, but obviously they were expressing a certain lack of warmth mm-hmm. for the man. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to Jerry, it may have been a shallow observation, but I said, I think you're right. I said, at that party, I didn't hear anybody with a good word about him except mm-hmm. the people who were speaking on the program, who mm-hmm. extolling his virtues. Other than that, there seemed to be a lot of resentment toward him. So I think there is a great deal of hostility out there, and maybe it can well be capitalized on. Shortly thereafter, and still before the general, as I recall, or it might have been right after the primary, one or the other, very close to the primary anyway. He and I met with a man named Horace Sheffield, you may have heard of him.
From the UAW?
Yes, Horace is a giant of a man, terrific, terrific fellow. Really dynamic. And he, at this lunch the three of us had, pledged to help Jerry if Jerry could sell himself to the TULC, which is Trade Union Leadership Council.
Right.
And shortly after the primary was over, and now I began to work full-time with, pretty much full-time, I was still trying to earn a living in my law practice too, as was he, we went to TULC, and Jerry spoke to the membership there, following which they agreed to endorse him. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever knew Jerry Kavanaugh.
No, I didn't. I never met him.
Well, he was a man of tremendous charm and a beautiful speaker. Mm-hmm. He had a great wit. A reporter for Newsweek once said to me, he said, I have met many politicians, and every president going back for some years, he said, John Kennedy and Jerry Kavanaugh are the two most charismatic, charming politicians I have ever met. Mm-hmm. So he would, this idea of what kind of a person Jerry was in his public image. Mm-hmm. Another illustration, just to point that out, near the end of his second term, Jerry had met a lot of hostility in Detroit, particularly in the Polish community. And he was invited to speak to the Romanowski, at Romanowski Post, to a meeting of Polish individuals in the southwest part of the city. I remember as we walked in the hall that night, I was just mumbling, grumbling, and kind of snide remarks made off to the side.
Was this hostility because of the racial situation in Detroit at the time?
Oh, I think it was many things. Of the tax situation, his stand on open housing, the Polish community didn't feel he had appointed enough Poles, mm-hmm. various things like that. When you run into hostility, there are usually many reasons for hostility. Anyway, there was a dinner after which he spoke. He spoke for only about 10 minutes to this rather hostile crowd and received a standing ovation as he walked out.
That's remarkable.
He had a wonderful way of winning people over.
I wonder if we could back up just a bit and perhaps fill in some gaps in the early period before Mr. Kavanaugh decided to run for mayor. You mentioned that you first became acquainted with Mr. Kavanaugh in law school.
I had met him at undergrad at U of D. And that both of us have been active in the Democratic Party.
The Young Democrats. Did you notice any particular traits about him that struck you immediately? I mean, we have the public image of Mr. Kavanaugh, and you were just talking about his charisma, which perhaps is something that, at least to the public, emerged when he was mayor of Detroit. Did you notice anything like that in his personality early on?
At that point, no, because we didn't see that much of each other. He was active in an organization called the Young Democrats. I in another organization called the Wayne County Democratic Club.
I see.
We didn't overlap.
Uh-huh.
But some people said to me, you should get to meet Jerry Kavanaugh.
Uh-huh.
One day, both of us happened to pass in the halls at U of D and stopped and spoke, sort of introduced ourselves and had a few words and went on our way. And I had no real immediate reaction, but others had told me that this was someone to watch.
As you got to know him in these early years, did he seem to have a definable personal or political philosophy at that point in his life as a student?
Political philosophy may be too broad a question, but he was certainly one who understood civil rights even in those days. I can illustrate with a point there. He was ahead of me in law school.
Mm-hmm.
But we were there at the same time. And he was head of the legal fraternity. And there was a black student whose name was Smith. And he was proposed as a member of the fraternity. And kind of surprising when you think back today, particularly at a place like University of Detroit, there was some hostility. Not an awful lot, but it only took one person to keep you from joining. And Jerry really led a campaign to bring this individual in.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know him as well as Jerry did, but he was seemed like a fine man to me, and we both thought he ought to get in, and I was working with Jerry in an attempt to bring him in. We did not succeed. He was kept out, but it was kind of a bitter sort of a circumstance. So that was my first real activity involved with Jerry, I would say.
One of the hallmarks of Mr. Kavanaugh's career, and you've alluded to it several times, are the good relations that he maintained, first of all, with the black community, and secondly, that he seemed to have sympathy is too strong a word and the wrong word, but he seemed to have some very strong feelings on the issue of civil rights. As a white Irish man coming from the city of Detroit, how do you explain that? He's one of the pioneers in the civil rights movement of that era. Was there something in his family background, you think, or his training or religious background that generated that, or would you have any idea? Did he ever reflect on that in conversations you may have had?
Oh, yes. That's something we did discuss, and it's a strange sort of a situation. Jerry's background and mine would be essentially the same. He went to St. Cecilia's School. I went to St. Teresa's. One was close to the other. St. Teresa's was located Grand River in Quincy. And a mile down the way at Livernois was St. Cecilia's. And so many of the people who later became involved in Jerry's campaign were young men and women who had gone to St. Cecilia's primarily and had known Jerry from there. So there were a typical Irish neighborhood crowd who were not particularly concerned about civil rights or rights of any minority group. Nor would Jerry's family background any more than my own, let's say, express any particular concern in there, and yet he had a great concern that came from nowhere about the rights of all minorities, the rights of blacks, the rights of women, and just the innate sense of justice. This isn't a very good answer, and yet it's a very difficult question for me to answer, because I can remember discussions we had concerning housing problems, and he knew, for example, that it was going to hurt him badly politically to come out in support of housing for lower financially people, let's say for poor people. And yet he felt it was absolutely something that injustice had to be done, even if he was going to take a beating because of it. So he wasn't afraid to do things that were unpopular because he felt they were right. I suppose part of this was his religious background. We had a common, we shared a common thing there, and we certainly had been taught that sort of thing in schools, but they taught a lot of things in school that you brush aside.
Right.
I think much of it, and this may sound like a strange answer, might even have come as a surprise to those who knew him very well, because a lot of people, those very, very close personal with Jerry, thought he was crazy to be running for mayor. You haven't got a chance. What are you? Why are you wasting everybody's time in doing this sort of thing? There were people very close to Jerry who didn't even bother coming down election night because they thought the whole thing was just a farce, and he had no chance of winning anyway. And these people certainly were people who loved him, thought well of him, and I'm certain influenced him in his life generally, and yet I think they never really knew some of the depths that were there.
Do you think that, and this is just a suggestion, as one who experienced the Jesuit education as a youth myself, do you think that the Jesuits at U of D, for example, who are noted for their strong sense of social justice, had any sort of an impact in his sensitivity to the civil rights issue in particular?
Oh, I think so. Regardless of others might dispute that, yes. I think you can't go through a Jesuit university without getting some of that feeling. Admittedly, at the time we were both at the University of Detroit, a lot of the faculty were not Jesuits, but there still were many there, and you had them in many of your classes. And particularly in sociology, in religion classes, even in my science class, I don't know that he had the same science class, but I know he had the same sociology classes, and our philosophy courses and the like. You were given a foundation in that sort of thing. And maybe in other things, too. I remember a Free Press writer trying to find out from me who we were going to, who Jerry was going to appoint as police commissioner. And Jerry had said, this is something, don't tell them, don't let them know. Well, the Free Press knew that somebody was under consideration. And the editors of the Free Press would get together with this reporter, who was Jack Casey. And they would frame a question for Jack or Earl Dowdy of the News, and they would come over and try the question on me. Or if Jerry were available, they would, of course, try it on him. And they never could get the answer. And I think it was Casey, although it might have been Doughty from the News, but I'm pretty sure it was Casey from the Free Press, who said, it's your Jesuit training, that's what it is. You don't lie to us, but you never tell us what we want to know.
I can relate to that, interestingly enough. Do you know of any particular individuals, any specific individuals or events or ideas that influenced Mr. Kavanaugh in his pre-public years?
Yes. Jim Friel.
How would you spell that?
F-R-I-E-L.
Okay.
Jimmy Friel, who was director of State Fair, and Jerry and Mary Helen Martin, later Kavanaugh, both were at U of D, and both worked at, I believe she did too, at the State Fair. Yes, she was secretary to Mr. Friedel, as I recall. And he was a man always interested in politics. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he was one of those who was first urging Jerry to run for mayor and had faith in his. Mm-hmm. In fact, he managed the primary campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only person I can name who had a great influence on.
Did Mr. Friel serve as something of a mentor then, early on, to
yes.
Mr. Kavanaugh?
Yes, he did.
Okay. I'm not really familiar with Mr. Friel. Could you fill us in on anything you might know about him, his background?
Well, other than he had been active in the Democratic Party for years, and I say had been appointed by governor, which governor I can't say, to manage the state fair, and that always goes to one who is among the political faithful.
Mm-hmm. That was a political plum
yes,
in those days.
Yes, right. And he had a general interest in things political, and liked to sit around and talk politics, mm-hmm. and Jerry had a great interest in politics. Uh-huh. Jerry was fascinated with politics. He could name every candidate for vice president, I think, in the history of the country and the year and so forth. He had a magnificent memory, great uh-huh. retentive powers.
Uh-huh.
And he could recall all of this. So he found Mr. Friel, with his political background, very uh-huh. interesting. Mr. Friel is deceased now, but they were very close during Jerry's younger years, particularly.
In 1955, Mr. Kavanaugh joins the law firm of Fred Romanoff and Joseph Sullivan. Now, is that Joseph A. Sullivan or Joseph B. Sullivan?
It's neither. No,
okay.
It was Leo Sullivan.
Leo Sullivan. Then the record is incorrect.
Correct.
According to the record, Joseph Sullivan was the senior partner.
No.
it was Leo Sullivan.
Yes.
Okay. Any relation to yourself?
No.
All right. So there was no connection professionally at that point.
No.
Okay.
We weren't even in the same building. I was
well, good. We've cleared the record in that one. Mr. Romanoff was a partner in that law firm, though, and he did join Mr. Kavanaugh's staff after the election as his executive secretary, I believe, correct?
Sometime later. I was the first executive secretary.
Okay.
And I left after about 6 months to run for prosecuting attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Unsuccessfully, I might add, mm-hmm. in the Democratic primary. And just to fill in that time, let's see, Freddie didn't take my place. Ray Girardin took my place.
Okay, okay.
And Ray was there for more than a year. I can't recall just how long, probably more than a couple of years. Then Ray left to become police commissioner, and Freddie Romanoff came, I think, at that time
okay.
to become executive
but
secretary.
Mr. Romanoff had been one of Mr. Kavanaugh's confidants.
Always had.
Very early on. They had been
yeah.
very close.
They had been. Freddie was a great, great guy, and one who would really stand up on issues. Freddie was not one to quibble about where he stood on anything. You know
uh-huh.
where Freddie was. He was a wonderful man. Still
very
is. Still he's retired. But
outspoken.
Outspoken. He just let you know where he stood, and he let you know where he stand. In fullness and fairness,
uh-huh.
Freddie was a good friend.
Uh-huh. Did he have any particular areas of expertise in particular that Mr. Kavanaugh leaned on him for?
Just as an attorney.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And Freddie was a good lawyer. Later became general counsel for the Michigan Bank.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He's retired now?
He has retired, yes.
Do you know if he's still in the Detroit area?
Yes, he's still in the area.
Okay.
I talked to him not too long ago.
Okay. He's another individual we'd surely like to talk to at some point for an interview. Let's move on then to the 61 mayoral campaign, and you've discussed why Mr. Kavanaugh decided he was going to run. I wonder if we could pursue for a bit the issue of where Mr. Kavanaugh received his support, first in the primary and then in the general election. You mentioned Horace Sheffield. and the TULC. What sort of assistance in particular could Mr. Sheffield and the TULC provide to the campaign?
That assistance primarily came during the general election. As I said, it looked to us from the lineup of candidates and just general help and a lot of help from U of D and St. Cecilia people who knew Jerry from those days. Well, that pretty much made up the primary campaign with some fundraising and some radio and television ads. It was our theory that we should announce big, act like we had money or something, and then we'd see what would happen. So we bought time for a 15-minute television spot. I don't think you'd even get that sort of thing today. Anyway, we bought 15-minute television. Jerry started out on that. It made a good opening sort of thing. And after that, there wasn't too much that we could do because we didn't have any money. And I say primary, and I can't speak too much of that because I was floating around the edge of it but never fully involved in it. Mm-hmm. When the general election came, we first got a speechwriter named Tommy McIntyre, who Jimmy Friel had contacted. Tommy McIntyre had worked for Senator Potter, among others, had been an old Times reporter. And he was to do the PR and the speech writing. The next thing to do was to raise some money, and I can say right now that through the entire campaign, we didn't raise more than $25,000.
This is in the general campaign?
The general campaign. But that was enough.
In those days?
Yes, in those days. And Mary Annie, one reason it was enough, because Mary Annie spent almost nothing.
Why do you suppose that was?
Because he didn't think young upstart Kavanaugh, who had never held any public office, had any chance at all. So he didn't make too many public appearances. It wasn't until near the end of the campaign that Mary Annie really began to show some concern, and not an awful lot even then. I just don't think that he or his people ever conceived that Jerry could possibly win. I had told you that when Jerry first broached this to me that I didn't see that we could win it, but that'd be fun trying. I later became fully convinced that we were going to win, and in fact, bet $100 even money. Mm-hmm. I didn't even ask for odds that we'd win. I might add that the fellow who I bet never paid off.
How did you become so convinced that you were going to win? What changed your mind?
We couldn't afford any public opinion polls, obviously, but one thing that both he and I did that began to really convince me, because of one thing or another, we had to use cabs quite frequently then for transportation, and we would play the same dummy role whenever we get into a cab. It would be something like this. I'm from out of town, but I notice you got an election going on here. Who do you think's going to win? The cab driver would inevitably say something like, well, Mary Annie's going to win it, but I'm going to vote for that Cahalan guy or some, some variation. It was never Kavanaugh. It was always something like that.
Right.
And I think there was just a lot of that in town. Uh-huh. Plus, we were certainly getting the support that Horace Sheffield had drummed up. I say we because I think in terms of the fact we were working together. But this whole thing, I deviate for a moment. After the election was over, various people took credit for Jerry having won. Jerry won that election because Jerry Kavanaugh was Jerry Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. He had the feeling for it. He had the ability. He had the ideas. He had the charisma. And wherever he went, he won people to him. Mm-hmm. So we were able to buy television spots to a limited extent. They were very inexpensive in those days. Mm-hmm. We were able to buy radio spots. And Tommy would write the speech because they wouldn't let you on unless you had a speech in advance. You couldn't. It might be that you didn't use the speech that you had turned in, but at least you had to have turned in a speech.
Yeah.
So my task would be probably to rewrite McIntyre's speeches. And, which is a story in itself, because Tommy was a very, very opinionated person and didn't want anybody touching anything he wrote.
Uh-huh.
And his, what he wrote was very good, except he always put his, vented his spleen at his personal enemies within the speech. And no speech was written without an attack on Charlie Edgecombe. And as Jerry tried to instruct Tommy, and as I did too, Jerry was not running against Charlie Edgecombe.
For the record, would you explain who Charlie Edgecombe was?
Charlie Edgecombe was county auditor and a power in county politics, but had absolutely nothing to do with any of this. But it would, the speech would contain such things as that rat Edgecombe. And I'm not exaggerating when I say there'd be lines like that in there. So it was my task to edit them out. And as a result, Tommy was always furious with me. And every time I'd have to go and fight with him to get the speech out of his hand.
Was this the campaign, or this, I know this was, but was it you who coined the phrase the Nichols and Novenas campaign?
No, I'm not the author of it.
Who came up with that phrase? Is that an accurate description,
yes,
do you think?
Yes.
$25,000 for the entire campaign.
What was that?
Were these all small donations? Were there any large financial backers to the campaign?
Offhand, the biggest contribution I can recall, I may be wrong in this, was $500. Now, there could have been 1,000. I'm sure there was nothing bigger than 1,000. But I can't even recall a $1,000 contribution. We put on parties primarily as fundraisers, maybe $25 parties, most of them. I don't think we even had a $50 fundraiser. Jimmy Friel and a man named Ron Seeley put on a small fundraiser, very personal sort of a fundraiser, some people they knew interested in politics and in business who contributed, I don't know how much each, but out of that meeting, I think we got $3,000 or $4,000 or something like that, which was the biggest boost we got.
So from a financial standpoint, would you characterize this as a grassroots campaign?
Oh, very definitely.
Very much so. You mentioned the neighbors in Mr. Kavanaugh's old neighborhood supporting him, I assume working as volunteers. And that,
yes,
sort of thing.
Oh, everybody worked as a volunteer. Now, the people who really, I feel, were the ones who were instrumental in Jerry's victory, in addition to Jerry himself, was the black community as organized by Horace Sheffield and TULC. Mm-hmm. And the firefighters of Detroit, who were very upset with Mary Annie. Mm-hmm. A fellow named Robert Ty was president of the Firefighters Union at that time, and he became very active, as did all of the officers and many of the firemen. Mm-hmm. They ran a headquarters for Jerry on the east side. We were able to rent an office on the west side. We probably got it for free, I can't recall now, and that was staffed by Patty Knox, among others, personal friends, John Healy, Bob Knox ran that one. Firefighters ran the one in the east. We had one downtown where I was myself. And then TULC, which was doing a tremendous job in organizing support in the black community. They had a campaign called, was it 4+1 or 5+1? I can't remember the exact, figured out, but the one was Jerry. Mm-hmm. The four or five were council candidates that they were supporting.
Mm-hmm. Why specifically were the firefighters upset with Mariani?
I think one of the reasons was the pay level between themselves and the police department. Mm-hmm. For a long time, their pay was always the same. Whenever you paid the police, you paid the firemen. And Mariani tried to upset that tradition.
Do you have any idea why Mariani did such a thing?
No, I can't say.
What about the policemen's organizations? What was their stand in the campaign? Did they endorse anybody?
whatever support they gave, it was for Mary Annie. Mm-hmm. There were a series of two or three meetings that we met, Jerry and I, with the heads of the police union. They were always rather secretive meetings because they didn't want it even out that they were considering supporting mm-hmm. Jerry, but they did not. Mm-hmm. I don't say that they gave Mary Annie a lot of support either, but they didn't give Jerry any real support.
Is it not true that in that campaign the UAW supported Mary Annie?
Yes.
Did that not present problems for Horace Sheffield, though?
Yes, it did. And Horace paid the penalty for it later on. When the UAW decided to elect a black vice president, Horace was the obvious first choice. Mm-hmm. But because he had gone name instead, Nelson Jack Edwards, mm-hmm. who, by the way, was also a very fine individual who had helped us also, but was not in the forefront of the entire thing, as mm-hmm. Horace Sheffield had been.
How shall I put this? You mentioned that early in the campaign, yourself, Mr. Kavanaugh, and Mr. Sheffield had lunch, in which I assume during that meeting, Mr. Kavanaugh and yourself asked Mr. Sheffield for his assistance and support in the campaign and so on. Was there any commitment on the part of Mr. Kavanaugh at that point to pursue civil rights issues if he did win the election?
No. Nor was it asked for, as I remember the conversation. And I really was just an observer there when I say that we had lunch. Jerry and Horace discussed the possibilities, and I pretty much sat in on it. But one thing Horace said that I do recall, he said, I have checked you with other people, and he said, I'm aware that you stood up for Mr. Smith and joining a fraternity at the University of Detroit.
Uh-huh.
So we know what your attitude is,
uh-huh.
and we feel that we can support you.
Where did organizations such as the local NAACP and some of the other civil rights groups stand, the Urban League?
Officially, I don't think they took any stand. I don't recall anything that involved any of them. I would say Jerry had almost full support from the black community.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall what the election figures were now,
mm-hmm.
but certainly he got the bulk of the vote of the black community. And interestingly enough about the UAW on election night, I had been covering a poll myself for a while, and then Jerry was going driving around, stopping at some polls, and he came to the one where I was at, and so we went on together, and I think it was the next one we pulled up at, there was a UAW fellow there circulating literature. Of course, we had a sign on the car. As we pulled up, he showed it to us and said, give me that Kavanaugh literature, will you? And he took the Mary Annie stuff and threw it and just tossed it in the trash barrel that was nearby. And I think there was probably a lot of that feeling among the rank and file of the UAW.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other key advisors in that 61 campaign that we haven't mentioned, key people who were involved?
I don't know if I should even go into this, but there was an article in the Free Press which, frankly, always amazed me. The article was the men behind Kavanaugh. It said the three people who had elected Kavanaugh were Jimmy Friel, Tommy McIntyre, and Lou Gordon. Lou Gordon had absolutely nothing to do with the campaign.
Wasn't he the TV personality?
Yes, he was. And Jimmy Friel had called Gordon and asked him to support Jerry, but he said he couldn't do it because he didn't think Jerry could win.
Uh-huh.
But he made some nice comments about Jerry. And at Jimmy Friel's request, agreed to let Jerry see what he had in the way of files on Mary Annie. But after Jerry visited and looked at the files, he came back and said to me, he said, there's no quarters. We had a suite at the hotel, the old Fort Shelby. People flocked up there, of course, one of whom was Lou Gordon. And to everybody, as they came there, I said to everyone who came in, you know, we couldn't have won without you.
Uh-huh.
It was true of the whole 50,000 or whatever.
Right.
In the hotel. Right. And Lou Gordon used that, told the reporter that as the proof that he was very involved, was one of the instrumental people in the campaign, was that I had said that they couldn't have won without her. Other than that, he didn't have a thing to do with the campaign. But he became very angry with Jerry, because Jerry refused to accept his advice on all appointments and what have you, and then launched, just attacked him viciously.
Huh.
I could go on for a long time on that one. Jimmy Friel had been very active, who's now deceased, as is Lou Gordon, as is Jimmy Friel. Had certainly been helpful, Payne, but the important people in that campaign really were Jerry Kavanaugh, Horace Sheffield, and Bob Tighe.
Uh-huh.
Those were the three people who won that campaign.
It's Tighe, T-I-G-H-E?
Yes.
Okay.
Healy later was appointed. Horace Sheffield would never accept an appointment. He could have had...
He would not accept an appointment.
He could have had any one of a dozen
appointments. Why do you think that was?
He just always felt he should work outside Salton and... was active in the next campaign, always was active in Jerry's campaign, but he would not accept any appointments. Mm. Nor from anybody of their people for taking an appointment. But Bob was an outstanding guy, smart, energetic, very capable, and deserved an appointment for the first, I think, maybe 4 years, but he finally did take it in the second.
That's interesting.
Great guy. He now lives in Florida. But I think I can speak without fear of successful contradiction, as they say, that those are the three people that won that election.
Okay.
And I resented, I couldn't help but resent the claim of a man like Lou Gordon, mm-hmm. claiming that he was one of the people who won that election, and that because Jerry didn't acknowledge all his tremendous help, that he turned against him.
During earlier conversation, you related to me the truth of the matter involving the Phooey Louie buttons. Would you care to relate that for the record?
Yes. In after he talks about the deluge of Phooey Louie buttons, which were circulated. The fact of the, I forget what his real first name was, but Nails was an attorney who operated mainly in recorder's court and traffic court. Very dapper individual, and he came over to the headquarters one day carrying with him a box of buttons which he had purchased himself, and showed me the buttons proudly, saying, "White print." I took one look at it and thought, "I've got to somehow get rid of these without letting them get out,"
uh-huh.
because that would have that. Time, maybe negative campaigning would work too, but we didn't believe in that sort uh-huh. of thing. Of course, I showed it to him, and he agreed with me that we ought to deep six these as fast as we could. So I preserved one for my collection of campaign buttons that I have at home, and gave the box to his sister, who was there working in the headquarters with us. And as I recall, she was going home, and I said, "Well, you take these and don't let them get out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
They're not to be distributed. Don't give anybody any of these."
Mm-hmm.
Why I didn't take them home myself, I can't tell. Anyway, to the best of my knowledge, they never were left that box. I had the one, which I put in my button collection, and not long ago, looking at my button collection, found that it is missing.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know who has my Phooey and Louie button, but to the best of my knowledge, that's the only one that got out of uh-huh. that box.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I assume that when the results came in, Mr. Kavanaugh was elated but not surprised at the outcome.
Well, let me tell you the story of that election night, which, by my one of the most fascinating evenings I ever spent in my life.
Excuse me.